Are we ready to boldly embrace the future? That's the question I pose, and I'll revisit it. Peter Cullen, who inspired me and communicated so well to so many, described the situation we face as one of inevitable adjustment. 6 points he made in what is now his last public speech in Adelaide were, number one, the lack of water. I quote from him, the lack of water is already having a devastating impact on irrigators and their communities, as we have already had the death of some permanent plantings in the basin, and more can be expected from both lack of water and from salinisation of water. There will be communities and crops that prosper and others that decline. Number two, there may be more annual crops and less permanent plantings. Number three, irrigation properties may become larger to cope with a mix of perennial and annual plants and more opportunistic irrigation. Four, we may see dairy farms leave irrigation areas and raise cows on fodder. Five, a critical issue for irrigation is whether to spend funds refurbishing old irrigation districts where properties may be too small and irrigation layouts inappropriate for current irrigation technologies, or to allow water to trade out and develop new irrigation enterprises on greenfield sites. Refurbishing last century's infrastructure may be silly when whole regions must be reconfigured with bigger farms and different irrigation layouts. And finally, there will be an overall contraction in the area irrigated, leading to issues of stranded irrigation assets and increasing operating costs to those remaining. That's not a bad summary of some changes we face. I'll miss Peter's voice in this discussion. I have no doubt the Darling Murray is over-allocated and in decline. The question is by how much? How much do we need to reduce extractions by? Is it 10%? Is it 20%? Is it 40%? We don't know, and I'm certainly not a qualified person to try and answer that. What I do want to answer and explore is how do we make the change? I want to look at three aspects: change, wealth, and fixes. Firstly, change. In change, it is useful to first look at what we want the change to achieve. What types of issues will our river, our community, and our economy need to adapt to in the future? So let's look ahead. Number one, climate change and rain. There will be many feedbacks from climate change, and just one of those feedbacks is that rain will be more variable, meaning we may face longer periods of reduced inflows. Putting that in context, for every 10% reduction in rainfall, there is typically a 30% or 30% plus reduction in runoff, the water that eventually fills our dams and our rivers. So potentially a future with much less water available in the river for consumption. Let's put water consumption in context. Let's look at food. The global average household water consumption per person per day is approximately 250 litres per person. Bit less in underdeveloped countries, a little bit more in developed countries. Here in Adelaide, 388 litres per person per day. On top of this is approximately a further 5,000 litres per day per person to provide your food, about half of that if you eat a vegetarian diet. CSIRO research indicates that if you eat a kilo of steak once a week, the amount of water required to grow the pasture to feed the cow will require almost 1 million litres of water a year. So get that, 1 kilo of steak a week consumes the equivalent of 4 average Adelaide homes, what they would consume in a full year. And importantly, while some of that water is no alternative use, the alternative use that's growing pasture for cows, and would not flow into rivers or lakes if it was not used by agriculture, there is still an important distinction. Household water consumption is almost insignificant compared to the amount we consume in producing food. In 05-06, Adelaide accounted for less than 1% of the total water that was taken out of the Murray-Darling. If Australia is going to solve the heartache and decline that is the over-allocation of the Murray-Darling, we will solve food production. Now, a third aspect of the change that we need to look forward to and adapt for. When we start accounting for the gases that cause climate change, commonly referred to as CO2 equivalents, the agriculture sector looms as playing a very significant role. This graph from the Department of Climate Change shows that agricultural, including forestry and fisheries, accounts for more emissions than any other sector in Australia. Generation of energy and transport often grabs a lot of headline media press. But when we look at where the energy is applied, where the transport is used, the picture is interesting. In agricultural terms, we're talking about pumping water, fertilisers, tilling soil, clearing stubble, transporting produce and so on. This graph highlights a slightly different detail. It highlights how energy intensive or how much energy is embedded in each tonne of a commodity produced. A tonne of beef requires 2.5 times as much energy as aluminium and more than 10 times as much as a tonne of steel. The point, when emissions trading is introduced and each tonne of CO2 equivalent is costed, there will be enormous pressures on agriculture to reduce their carbon footprint, to be produced as efficiently as possible. If a cost of $25 per tonne of CO2 equivalent was used, agricultural, forestry and fisheries would be facing a $3.6 billion cost. I just want to emphasise, I'm using the word agriculture, also including forestry and fisheries. But it accounts for about 2/3 of the total number. The conclusion out of that, adapting to that future, agriculture will be very, very motivated to reduce costs associated with things like fertilisers and the energy required to pump water. How might we do that? Double the wealth from half the water. We will need to focus on Peter's suggestion of doubling the wealth we produce from agriculture while halving the water. Not doubling the output, doubling the wealth. Part of that involves understanding what crops produce wealth. Ideally, we'd look at the bottom line and understand what wealth means, but profits aren't readily shared in the industry, so we'll just have to look at a reasonable indicator, and that's revenue. Here is a graph of water used per hectare versus water used per megalitre. So I'll say that again. A graph of water used per hectare versus dollars per megalitre. For pasture, it shows that South Australia uses almost 6 megalitres per hectare, twice as much as an equivalent farm in New South Wales, and produces less than $200 per megalitre. For grapes, it shows Victoria uses 3 times as much water per hectare as we use in South Australia. South Australian grapes produce almost $3,000 per megalitre, 15 times as much as South Australian pasture. For vegetables, it shows that Victoria grows vegetables for almost half the water we use in South Australia, producing almost $5,000 per megalitre, almost twice the value per megalitre of South Australian veggies, and 25 times as much revenue per megalitre as South Australian pasture. As the size of the markers indicate, South Australia, New South Wales and Victoria use more water on low-value crops than high-value. A total of 2,000 megs, 2 gigalitres, 2,000 gigs, 2,000 megs on pasture and less than 250 megs in total on veggies. One conclusion you can draw from that, while the variation in efficiency reflects a mix of climate, natural rainfall, soil types, there is also a reasonable conclusion that some areas have a comparative advantage in sowing certain foods. So crop type and location are drivers of doubling agricultural wealth and halving the water. How do we do that? Another driver of doubling the wealth and halving the water is precision irrigation management and technology. One example that captures precision irrigation beautifully is an Adelaide-based company who produce and export beautiful, luscious, vine-ripened tomatoes. Go into Woolies, they're there for about $10 a kilo, and they're not the hard, polished, tasteless variety. The precision irrigation story behind these tomatoes is amazing. They reuse city wastewater that has been treated to a level where it is safe, purify it further by passing it through reverse osmosis, then they add in a specific mineral diet customised precisely for the tomatoes in a glasshouse where soil moisture monitoring technology delivers the precise amount of water precisely when it is needed to optimise root growth and plant yield. Water is further supplemented by 50 megs of rainwater harvested off the roof every year. The glasshouse is more like an operating theatre of a hospital than a typical glasshouse. It is heated to a constant 25 degrees by using the waste heat of an on-site gas-fired cogeneration electricity plant, and the CO2 is injected into the glasshouse. lifting CO2 levels from about 380 parts per million, what they are out on the street today, to about 1,200 parts per million. And the tomatoes just gobble up that CO2, they can't get enough of it. Now the amazing part, the numbers that come out of this business, the numbers that come out of this precision irrigation business. 12 times the normal tomato plant yield, using 1/10 of the water, selling the produce for twice the price into the market, not into a fluctuating auction market, a fixed constant price. A stunning example of what precision irrigation can do to double our wealth. And an interesting point is there are probably 20 or so South Australian technology and management suppliers who could be in that value chain behind the tomatoes, from the world leading membrane ion exchange filtration, or MIEX wastewater reuse treatment technology, pioneered right here in Adelaide and exported to the world, pioneered by SA Water and United Water. Osmoflow's desalination, Australia's largest manufacturer of desal plant, is based right here in Adelaide with 250 plants operational around the world. Fiberglass pipe fittings made by local companies. Philmac with their soil, with their pipe fittings. Soil moisture monitoring technology invented right here in Adelaide by companies like Centec and Aquaspy that communicate when plant roots need a drink and for how long. On top of that, there's the science from our globally recognised research institutions like SARDI and the Australian Water Quality Centre. The list goes on. It's actually an interesting aside. The South Australian Water Technology and Services have exported more than $2 billion of water services and technologies in the last 10 years out of South Australia. Now, let me emphasise, precision irrigation may or may not involve glasshouse production. The essential ingredient is optimising water use, and South Australia is a world leader in it. We have the precision irrigation technology that is emerging as critical to responding to climate change. So if that is a look at the future, highlighting that climate change demands we embrace precision irrigation and creates an opportunity to double the wealth, the agricultural wealth, while halving our water use. So what do we have to do to get there? Let's look at the fixes. I broadly see two paths forward, and both require an efficient water trading mechanism. The point I'm making, Ken laid out 14 options. I'm laying out two, because fundamentally I'm wrapping up a whole lot of options within water trading. The point of trading is that water gets used where it is most valuable, including the critical value of maintaining river systems we depend on, often referred to as iron environmental flows. It moves from someone who gets little value from it to someone who is prepared to pay more for it and is smarter with their use of it. Water trading offers an integrity that cannot be replicated by politicians or bureaucrats. So given that water trading must happen, there's two paths. Number one is improvement. Speeding up the reforms, especially water planning and defining sustainable levels of extraction that Ken spoke of, needed to improve the functioning of the water trading market and establish the federal body recently agreed to by COAG. However, this needs to solve three substantial hurdles. The water trading market is not transparent and information is not available to all participants. The solution to this has been discussed for years, a national trading register with efficient transfer mechanisms. We need it desperately. Number two, good irrigation performers right now are being punished and poor performers are being rewarded. Efficient high-value irrigators who have invested in their own money in precision irrigation technology and are probably still carrying the debt of those investments are now watching with dismay as government rewards areas that haven't invested in modernising their irrigation, potentially compounded with poor salinity management, and that reward for that poor performance, a financial handout. Industries that are propped up with handouts really make the necessary changes to emerge strong and competitive, meaning our agricultural sector is unlikely to emerge well-placed to respond to climate change. The third hurdle we need to overcome, irrigation district companies can stifle the trading of water out of their districts, a logical response to the risk of seeing their irrigation network assets become stranded. Many of these irrigation companies arose from community representation and emotionally the profound asset many of these irrigation companies are trying to protect is their very own community. Surely there would be a more effective social welfare policy mechanism to assist these communities through the transition some of them must inevitably face. So option one, improve what we are doing. Option two, the Big Bang. Mike Young will expand on this, but here's my version of the Big Bang. Government compulsorily acquires all water entitlements through a buyback, and then as a first priority, apportions sufficient of this water to meet the needs of the river and the environment, and then auction the remainder back to willing buyers. We would very quickly reduce over-allocation, the river would quickly become functioning and healthy, and the irrigation that remains will be well placed to double the wealth from half the water. So let's summarise. I set out by posing the question, are we ready to boldly embrace the future? I spoke about what changes need to achieve, adapting to climate change, efficient food production and emissions reductions. Then we looked at doubling our agricultural wealth from half the water, and we looked at what crop, where and how we grow it, precision irrigation. Then we looked at fixes, the need for a trading system and the paths of improvement or the Big Bang. In answer to my question, my sense is that we, the community and government, is not prepared to boldly embrace the future. We have been prepared to make the environment pay, to make future generations pay, and to make our economy pay, initially through ignorance of the consequences of our actions, but that excuse ran out long ago. We need to act boldly to create a healthy Darling Murray that provides good quality water for communities including Adelaide. We need to act boldly to create a healthy Coorong and Lower Lakes ecosystem. We need to act boldly to create an irrigation sector that produces food to meet our needs and the looming needs of responding to climate change, and do that while producing sufficient wealth for rural communities. We need to act boldly to create an irrigation sector that can create enough wealth to pay its way without expecting billions in government handouts. We can blame our politicians for procrastinating and not delivering this, but in a great democracy like Australia, governments largely reflect the will of the people. And that means we have failed to give politicians the clear message that we, the community, demand and are prepared to pay for sustainable water management. In closing, I ask every single person in this room to do one thing. Please talk to your politician, to your talkback radio host, to your neighbour, to your family, to your workmate, to anyone who's prepared to listen about the price you are prepared to pay for sustainable water. Thank you.